We'll get this meeting of the State Government Finance Division started. Representative Quong.
I'm going to.
Have you read the minutes? You've been, we're here early and.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the minutes and found them adequate, and thus would move those minutes.
Representative Quong moves the minutes of February 20th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Representative Wolgamott. He was here. Oh.
Freshman.
Whoa.
Okay.
He went to get the candy. Donuts.
I move we table his bill until forever.
Mr. Glazer, are you ready to? Let's see, walks in. No, here, Representative Wolgamott. Already starting up on a bad foot and take. I'll move House File 2490 to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Wolgamott, you want to explain your bill? And
absolutely. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present to you House File 2490, which is a bill that establishes a grant program for state parks throughout the state of Minnesota, authorizing the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission to build skate parks all throughout our state. I'm bringing this bill forward because I'm a father of two, and I think it's really important that we give kids opportunities to go outside and recreate, to put the phones down, to put the video games down, and go out and spend time outdoors with other people. It's always good. So that's the gist of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, but I've got some much more interesting testifiers here that can explain this bill and the good that it will do for my constituents, for your constituents, and for the entire state here with me today.
Well, thank you. And if they want to come down and start, I don't have a list of names. Well, I have a Marker Argarita and a Paul Forsline. Paul Forsline, okay. If you guys want to just come and line up down here so we can make the time go quicker so that we have a couple other bills on the agenda this morning. So we want to get through these things as quickly as we can. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
I'm Paul Forsline. I am president of City of Skate. We're a nonprofit advocacy group out of Minneapolis. And to explain why we're here to talk about skate parks, we started a number of years ago advocating for skate parks in Minneapolis and to make the quality of skate parks acceptable for skating and really a community asset. And what we found out after a few months of success and actually getting skate parks designated Minneapolis, we started getting calls from all over the state, from parents, kids, people from your district that have been trying to get quality skate parks in their communities for years and getting nowhere with that. And so I just want to tell you a story of skate parks and why they're important to the communities. And I also want to put into your minds what a skate park looks like, because I think whatever you're thinking for a skate park is probably not what we're talking about. So the program's broken down into three parts. There's $2.5 million that go towards community skate parks, so smaller scale skate parks. These are matching grants, so $250,000 is going to go towards a $500,000 skate park. There's also regional skate parks, which is a community skate park, so that's a smaller scale skate park community. You got regional skate parks. That's a skate park that would have a draw, say in Rochester, St. Cloud, Duluth. And you know, think of municipalities as working with their counties to build a larger skate park to draw kids from the region. And then lastly, there's a part of the bill that's for a statewide skate park. So it's a large facility. It would fit the needs of beginners all the way up to Olympic athletes. And by the way, the Olympics are hitting in Tokyo this year, and skateboarding is being added, men's and women's athletics. We anticipate a huge increase in the demand for skateboarding, especially from the women's side of skateboarding. Just to let you know, this is on your doorstep. Des Moines, right here, the image I'm showing is a $6 million skate park that they're building right now to be the largest in the country. So this is happening all around us. Madison has a park. Sioux Falls is working on a park. This isn't something unique. Also want to put in context skateboarding. These facilities are just as valuable as baseball fields, football fields, tennis courts, and actually it's a great taxpayer investment. The fact that if you look at this image, a skate park will often have 50 users using it at one time compared to, say, a premier football field, premier baseball field. It's a lot of quality content for this investment. Another breakdown, this is in your pamphlet. The breakdown is funny for skate parks. The issue is it's the upfront costs. Once the skate parks are built, the management operation is almost, it's not nothing, but it's in the single digits compared to your premier baseball fields, your softball fields, football, soccer fields. So it's the upfront costs. This is the hurdle we're trying to get over. And this matching dollars is really what's going to make the difference in these communities and make the skate parks quality. So here's the bad news. Here's about 95% of the skate parks in Minnesota right now. This is what they look like. They're modular equipment built by playground people, not skateboarders, put on asphalt. Asphalt turns into sandpaper after literally a year. The ramps start sinking into the asphalt. They've become unrideable. And that's what our expectations have been for skate parks for years and years. And that's really a majority of almost all the skate parks in our state are this way. And actually, by the way, some of these are some of the skate parks in your districts. So we'd like to change that. Here's a good story, St. Cloud. Part of the reason Representative Walgamott is here. This skate park, the young gentleman in the corner, Austin Lee, actually had to get appointed to their park and rec board and actually served as chairman by the time he was 18 to get this park done. It took from the year 2000 to 2010. It's a state-of-the-art skate park. It's a huge success. Unfortunately, it needed to be moved because of a Costco thing. But St. Cloud values skate parks so much, they're building a new skate park for $1.3 million. And if you need anybody to convince you of the value of skate parks, talk to Mayor Kleiss up there. He's a raving fan of skate parks, and we'll talk to any of you about the quality and the benefit of skate parks. Again, what makes a skate park great? It needs to be unique. It needs to be custom, concrete, not the cookie cutter asphalt modular units that we have all about. And here's some examples. I just want you to see some images of skate parks around the country, around the world, where they've integrated them into the community. They've taken aspects of the community heritage and put that into design and made them really spaces of gathering for the whole community. And this, again, you might be thinking Minnesota, skateboarding, this is a California thing. This is happening all around the world. Actually, Denmark and Sweden are probably the leaders right now in skate park infrastructure and what's going on. Again, when they're quality built, concrete, custom, they're active spaces, they're not inactive. You see weekends packed skate parks when they're built like this. And we want them to be comfortable, programmable, really community assets. They can be right in the heart of the cities. City of Skate, we're lucky we partnered with another nonprofit, North Minneapolis. We built this facility. It's a skate spot, 3,000 square feet. We had kids here nonstop last year. It's been a raving success. And we actually gave out 60 skateboards in this location this last year to kids at BEAD. And it was nonstop action. This can happen in any community in the state. So it's not just in your park systems. This can be right in your commercial districts, even if you have a piece of property that needs to be activated. And again, it's an intergenerational thing. We have skaters now that are my age. By the way, I'm not a skater. I'm a parent. I grew up with my kids now in their 20s. Never had a neighborhood skate park to skate at. And that was of any quality. We traveled. We went to places. We went to St. Cloud. So, and we're looking for these skate parks to be something we pass on to the next generation. These are spaces that our communities are proud of. It's just as important as our ice arenas. It's just as important as our field sports spaces. And it's really a signature spot for communities all across the state. So we hope you'll support the funding. The mechanism in place is duplicating the Mighty Ducks initiative. It's a proven method of getting these grants throughout the state. We're just applying it to a different activity, an activity that we really believe has been undervalued by our state and really needs to be embraced just to help our communities, help youth. And I hope you'll support this. I'm going to turn it over to Marsha Hovey, who's a member of City of Skate.
I have a Mark Rodriguez, but you're not Mark.
I'm not Mark. I'm so sorry.
Anyway, just.
Good morning, everybody. I am Marsha Hovey. I have never done this before. This is very exciting, and I hope that you are excited to talk about skateboarding. I don't know how often that comes up in these meetings.
Skateboarding.
What's that?
It's just like skateboarding. You roll with it.
Exactly. Very great morning metaphor at 8:05 a.m. Impressive. So my name, again, is Marsha Hovey. I am a board member of City of Skate. I am 31. I've been skateboarding for 7 years. And when you think of a skateboarder, if you can close your eyes and imagine a skateboarder, do you imagine a young girl or a woman as a skateboarder? I won't judge you if that answer was no. But I'm here to make it very clear that when we talk about skateboarding, we are talking about an activity that is done by all. Females in skateboarding is the fastest growing demographic in action sports. So we are not just talking about your 13-year-old boy. We are talking about girls. We're talking about adult women. We're talking about boys, men, cross generations, cross cultures, cross races, and absolutely cross genders. So I just want to make that very clear that I am a skateboarder. I represent a lot of women in the area that feel that we don't have facilities that are comfortable for us to use, that are inviting for a younger generation. And it's one of those things that if you are a young girl and you don't see any other girls doing that activity, why do you think that it's for you? You probably don't. So I grew up outside New York City, did not have access to skate parks, very much like the suburbs of the Twin Cities. I did not start skateboarding until later in life when I was in Portland, Oregon. Oregon is a great example of an area that is really utilizing skate parks as living sculptures and great community spaces. Hi. So I started skateboarding because I was going to these places with friends and saw women skateboarding. That was amazing to me. And it really inspired me to start. I ended up then working with an organization called Skate Like a Girl, which gets young women into skateboarding. I work specifically with girls ages 3 to 7, which is adorable. And it's such an amazing thing to watch the confidence that comes out of skateboarding, the courage that it takes. I don't know if any of you were watching the Oscars, but there's a wonderful documentary about a program called Skate-A-Stan. The documentary just won the Oscar for best film, and it is amazing. I highly recommend it. It's a great example of what can be done just through a sport that a lot of people have written off as maybe a counterculture or something that will not be as popular as football or hockey. We have this horrible cycle that Paul mentioned where towns will invest in these skate parks that are cheaper and prefab, and then they don't last, and then you have parents and city officials saying, well, nobody uses that skate park, why would we invest in another? Well, it's because the wrong thing was invested in. If we are investing in concrete skate parks that really are the center point, we will have people traveling to our state to experience those skate parks. I personally have skated in 12 states just because I want to go experience what other states have. And it's an amazing thing where you walk into a skate park and you automatically have a community, whether that is saying hi to a woman or a young girl that is there or finding out that you have friends that you didn't even know existed in a new place. So I just want to be very clear that when we talk about skateboarding, we are talking about a wide range of people, a wide range of ages, girls especially, and I really hope that this is something interesting for you guys to chat about today. And if you want to come skateboarding with any of us, we are more than welcome to get you on board. So thanks for listening to us.
Thanks for your testimony. next we have, is this Paul Rodriguez?
We're just really keeping you on your
head. Oh, is he not? Okay.
Gave you was a little out of order.
Yeah, well, yeah, just whatever it is. Yep, okay, we're flexible here.
My name is Mark Rodriguez, and I'm here to talk a little bit about skateboarding and the skateboarding economy. I'm a local business owner. I run a skateboard park called The Third Layer. We've been in business operating now out of Golden Valley for the last 23 years. I myself am a lifelong skateboarder. I got my first board at 8 years old, and I have dedicated my life to not only riding and challenging myself, but also creating opportunities for more people to be involved with skateboarding. So my business, we do a lot of different things, and I believe that we've got a unique insight into the need that does exist out there. Being a for-profit business means that for people to use my facility, they not only have to pay, but oftentimes drive very far. They have to fill out a waiver. And there are enough skateboarders in this state that over 10,000 of them do that every single year. We pull people from communities all over Minnesota, places like Mora and Grand Rapids to Minneapolis and Minnetonka. We run youth programming in partnerships with communities just like yours, skateboard camps that we operate out of communities like Mendota Heights, Woodbury, Cottage Grove. We do a youth contest series called Summer Series that operates in communities all over the Twin Cities like Shoreview and St. Louis Park. The list goes on and on. The need for youth to have access to skate parks today is more so than ever. As my colleague stated, as Marcia stated, one of the fastest growing demographics in skateboarding today is women. There are heroes out there. There are women competing at a very high level. We're going to see them in the Olympics this summer along with their male counterparts. There are disability groups out there. We work with a local nonprofit called Adaptive Skate Collective that's run by a double amputee of the legs who introduces skateboarding in an empowering way to the youth of the Twin Cities that struggle with various physical and mental limitations. And a lot of those kids end up transitioning right into our normal daily programming. The beautiful thing about skateboarding that we've seen is that when there's access to it, kids will flock to it. It's conducive to the types of lifestyles that we live these days, in that there's not a lot of time. People find themselves running from work to practice to other practice, dropping kid off here, dropping kid off there. What skateboarding offers, especially if you have a facility in your community, is a quick 20-minute, 30-minute, 40-minute commitment, whatever you want to do with it. You don't need to organize your team. You don't need to be on time to a practice. If your parents bring you to the skate park, there's going to be other people there doing it with you. It's not an overly competitive environment. We like to say at our business that there are no rules with how to skateboard. It's very expressive, but it's also very physical at the same time. So for youth in today's world of screens, to be able to have something that allows them to be creative, it allows them to be active simultaneously, it allows them to feel included no matter what their ability is, what their limitations are, what their gender is, what their background is, and if we have skate parks in communities, no matter what their economic circumstances are, they can be a part of this community that is one of the most welcoming communities that I've ever been involved with anything that I do. I'm just here to tell you, as a for-profit business owner, you may think it might be counterintuitive for me to ask you to fund free spaces for these youth to come to, but I believe in it that much. We've been able to stay open for 23 years, not because people have to come to us, but because we've created an environment where people want to come to us. And we want to be a part of a solution that allows any kid anywhere in this state the opportunity to participate in action sports. So hopefully you all take into consideration what we're asking. We don't feel like we're asking for a ton of money. We're not asking for the state to fund 100% of anything. We go out and we fundraise. We would ask the community members to do the same. We'd ask the municipalities to get some skin in the game. All we're asking for you is to help bridge the gap that prevents the skate parks that are being built from being the skate parks that we can be proud of as skateboarders and as community members here in the state of Minnesota.
Well, thank you. And anybody else, and I understand that there's a couple here that's coming forward or a team that's coming forward. And if there's anybody else that wants to speak to or for this, if you want to head on down towards there, please welcome the committee and please state your name for the record.
Hello, I'm Whitsy Asoko.
And I'm Cora Neeson.
I wanted to speak on behalf of City of Skate, which is a nonprofit organization that helped design a skate park in North Minneapolis with Juxtaposition Arts. The North Side is low income and mostly kids of color that are in the neighborhood. It's the highest concentration of youth in the city. You may see this is a North Side issue, but overall the state, there's so many youth, and this is a good way to retain youth and to start with youth by designing spaces for them. I'm a lifelong skateboarder. I've been a part of skateboarding for over 30 years. And what it gave me was self-confidence and identity and a determination to do things regardless of teams, regardless of practices. And that's what we find is an amazing thing with skateboarding, is that it's a really low barrier to participation as far as cost. And once you're involved, there isn't a dependence on a ton of other people aside from getting there, right? So, but we're here, me and Cora are really here to talk about Juxtaposition Arts. We spent the summer working with kids maybe that hadn't skateboarded for the first time, and we found it hugely impactful. I'll hand it off to Cora, though.
Yeah, so my role at the plaza was a skate plaza host, which was mostly handing out rental boards, but also just being a steward of the space. And in that role, I really saw the power that skateboarding and quality skate parks have to really empower youth and be a catalyst for healthy and thriving communities. Skateboarding, I think, is rooted in physical space a little bit more than other activities, being that it is about looking at the space around you and really being in it and using that to create a new expression. And because of that, I think it grounds skateboarders in their community in a really powerful and unique way. And we saw this at Juxtaposition. All these pictures show. It's a really powerful space to be in when you apply this to youth. And when youth feel that they are invested in the space around them, and when they are part of a community, that is a really powerful investment in their future and their engagement in not only the community, but also sort of democracy as a whole. And also on the individual level, there's a growing body of research that shows that skateboarding activates all of the parts of the brain to heal trauma. Skateboarding also encourages healthy risk taking. It encourages personal autonomy and choice. And these are all things that are really, really important when we think about investing in the power of our youth. So on the individual level, on the communal level, on the societal level, investing in skate parks is investing in youth. It's investing in their power. It's investing in our communities. And really only positive things happen, which I saw at Juxtaposition.
And I have one question about where is this Juxtaposition, the picture on here, and where is that?
Yes, Juxtaposition Arts is at the corner of Emerson and Broadway. We would love to show you if you're in town. Make a trip up. It's now being thought out.
I know the area well. I thought I recognized the building.
Everybody, now the kids are shoveling it out. So it will be ready to go, hopefully, in the coming days, now that we're getting warmer weather. This skate park is designed in a way, Paul showed you an older model, which is really based on like skateboard equipment as playground equipment. And this was really designed with the user first. And that's what I want to encourage, that thought. And it does take a little bit more resources as far as finances go. But it really adds, the initial cost is up front. But in the end, the long-term payback is much greater when it's focused on user-centered design. And this is what we did here. We worked with the environmental design group at Juxtaposition Arts. They're a group of kids that learn about landscape architecture, and they're placed into jobs afterwards. So this is a portfolio piece by a bunch of teenagers that created this space. We'd love to talk to you a little bit more about that, but I don't need to put that onto this hearing. Overall, we only had the skate park for 4 months, and over 500 kids were coming a month, mostly from the neighborhood, but we are drawing from all over Minnesota because the quality of skate parks is not that high, and this was a high-quality skate park. Even though it's only a 3,000-square-foot space, people were driving from all over the state. But I really want to encourage you to support this skate park funding. Like I said, it's a very and the initial cost is up front, but the long-term benefit is great and goes on for many, many years. Thanks for for listening to us, and we hope you support this bill. One more thing. We wanted to invite you to the Skate Park Advocacy Day on April 2nd. We're going to be having a skateboard demonstration outside of the Capitol on the promenade, and we'll also have a rally at the Capitol. We'll send you more information, but that is detailed in your handout that we gave you. So thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? And Representative, I see there's an amendment here, and we should probably get this in order. And it looks to be just a changing of a date. So I'll move the amendment of H2490A1. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. And I guess questions now. I got Representative Nash, who have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and certainly do support kids skating. I've got a giant wad of kids at home, and they skateboard and longboard. But putting my former mayor's hat back on, when we did a skate park in the city of Waconia, we just took care of it as a municipal park. And I'm wondering, Representative Wolgamott, why that's not the case in your bill, and why the state is building, I think, what is it, $8.25 million worth of skate parks? And I'll have some follow-ups, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wolgamott.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, that's great that your community had the resources to do that. Unfortunately, that's not the case throughout all communities in Minnesota, and the intent of this bill is to make sure that all kids throughout Minnesota, regardless of the local resources that your community has, that our state invests in their health and their well-being, and ensure that they have those opportunities to excellent skate parks. And I would also draw members' attentions to line 2.12 and 2.13. To the extent possible, 50% of all grants must be awarded to communities in greater Minnesota. So this is a bill to make sure that we're investing in communities all throughout the state.
Can I address that question? Is that possible?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Yeah, so Mr. Representative Nash, your skate park is actually the top left up there. So that skate park, the ramps have actually fallen into the asphalt. I know a group in your town actually has been trying for over 10 years to get a better quality skate park there. They even got as far as get a concept drawn up, which would have been a custom concrete park. And unfortunately, like many towns across the state, that has fallen to the wayside. So, again, skate park there, not at the highest use. Again, going down the road of a modular park, again, the story of youth in your city trying to convince their parks to build a quality skate park and unable to get there. And we're hoping this bill, with these matching funds, it's kind of the impetus for these park and rec programs to say the money's available, this can match our money, we can actually build a custom skate park, something that will last 20, 30 years versus something here that was probably usable for 3 years. And after that, you probably saw the use decline rapidly. And it's just the story that happens across the state.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wolgamott, talk to us about the matching, because if cities can't apparently do this and or have chosen not to in their CIP programs, how is that going to work?
Representative Wolgamott.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, you can take a look at lines starting at 1.20 through 1.22, talking about all the different opportunities that cities can have, including in-kind contributions of land, access roadways, access roadway improvements, necessary utility service, landscaping, parking. But those are the in-kind contributions that we're asking for.
I think you'll see. I'm sorry.
Representative Nash, do you have?
Or he can.
Mr. Forsline.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. Representative Nash, I think a lot of times the skate parks, even in your community, when you see them build it, you see the matching money coming from Park and Rec. You might see them come from the city. You'll see the Lions Club chip in. You'll see pancake breakfast, whatever. It's usually skate parks are constructed with a lot of sources coming in. What the state grant does, it just leverages it to actually make the cities a quality skate park. And I guess another thing I failed to mention, often the skate parks that get made successfully and well made, the biggest regret of every city that when that happens, when they get the resources together to actually build a custom concrete skate park, their biggest regret is the fact that they don't make them big enough. And it's true, because it's a success. And it's overused versus underused, and they wish they had something bigger. And I know that was the case in St. Cloud. Their next skate park is bigger than the first one. And I know Mayor Kleiss up there also wants more skate parks. They're a success when they are funded to the max and to the point where they're actually a solid capital investment.
Representative Nash?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to continue, so Representative Wolgamott, an $8.25 million appropriation. Again, I'm advocating that if cities want to do this, they should put it in their long-range CIP like we did in Waconia for the different priorities that we had as a community. But how many skate parks is $8.25 million going to build if it's a matching grant or whatever? So help us understand to the level that you – and I'm not – so the level that you say you'd like to have these built, how much does that get built?
Representative Wolgamott, Mr. Forsling.
So I guess to break it down, there's the three levels of grants, right? There's the one that's a state draw skate park. That's one skate park, okay? Bring it down to the regional skate parks. That is $3.75 million. Matching-wise, if it was the max grant, it would be $750,000, so that's five skate parks for regional. I don't necessarily believe the grant doesn't have to be $750,000, so I think that could be up to 10 skate parks at a regional draw. And then you have your community skate parks at $250,000. Well, there's at least 10 skate parks there. If each grant is the max, but I would suspect that also be drawn out from 10 to 20 skate parks. So we're looking at 30 skate parks as well with a statewide draw. I also think this will be a catalyst, though. This is the key part of this bill. This is something that once these skate parks are built, I think other communities, other parts of the state are going to see the value of these skate parks and will initiate them to designate money for those skate parks. So this is really an impetus to not only the skate parks within this bill, but actually to inspire other cities to take a look at the example of St. Cloud. And I guess the other city I'll call it is Burnsville. Burnsville actually built a quality skate park. And again, raving success. It's an example to other cities, and it's really how skate parks need to be built to be success and be actually a value for tax dollars.
Representative Nash?
Just a real quick last couple questions. If you could address the ongoing maintenance of these, what's going to happen with the grants there, and the insurance, which is always going to be a little bit more on something like this, not something that has been addressed in the bill. Are you going to, is part of the grant or the future second bill, is that going to be having the state cover insurance for these things, or what's going on there?
Representative Wolgamott. Mr. Forsling.
Yes. Chair Nelson, so skateboarding is an at-risk activity. It's no different than being in a swimming pool, being on your bike going down a state trail. So the liability is not there. It's an at-risk activity. Recreational use statute in our state actually covers this and the fact that it's a known recreational use. So liability is really, it's not existent. It's something that happens on public land and park space. So it's no different, you know. It's funny, we get this question because everybody thinks skateboarding is dangerous, and it's actually, statistics show that skateboarding is no dangerous than soccer, basketball, definitely not as dangerous as hockey or football. So it's something that is often thrown out there as a caution, but it's happening everywhere in the world. These parks are being built everywhere. So just to hopefully that causes, you know, addresses your concerns.
And Mr. Chair, the maintenance question?
Mr. Nash.
Representative Nash, the maintenance, so these are concrete skate parks. So the maintenance on a concrete skate park, when built properly, is minimal. I would say yearly, I know the budget in Minneapolis system is $7,000 per skate park for the maintenance. I think compare that to ongoing for baseball fields, football fields, hockey arenas, it'd be a small comparison. So, again, we're saying a 20-year longevity for a skate park, possibly 30 years.
Representative Acom. Wake up.
I'm with, sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I didn't mean to shock you.
I happen to be on the Eagan City Council.
Mason Acom.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
We sound alike. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really want to thank the author for bringing the bill forward. I think any activities that we can provide to get kids outside is beneficial. I know I have friends whose family trips would be, road trips would be taken, and they would stop in communities around the country that had skate parks. So I think that's great. So my question is about the community, skate community. In Minnetonka, we just recently went through developing a mountain bike park, and it was driven much by the mountain bike community as it's grown within schools and the schools developing mountain bike teams. And so as you had said that this is going to be an Olympic sport this year, I'm wondering, are there school teams or community teams that might help drive the location or placement of some of these parks? I think that would be a helpful impactor where communities might be open to it.
Representative.
And one second, we're running short on time, so if we can keep our questions short and our answers short, it would be help us get done in time.
Okay. Representative, actually, I can give you an example for Minnetonka. 2 years ago, City of Skate received an email from Alyssa Goll, who's a middle school teacher at Minnetonka Middle School. And there was a problem there at the school. Their kids after school, many of them were going to the neighboring shopping center looking for places to go. Their middle school kids, no place to go. She grew up skateboarding. She decided, how about I start a skateboard club? She put out a list. She had 40 kids signed up within 24 hours. She had to stop the list. She couldn't handle anymore. She came to us because she has no place to take these kids. She was using parking lots, gym, no skate park in Minnetonka. No place for her to take these kids. So there's just an example. There is a need there. There's the demand. Without the facilities, you're not going to see a demand unless you have individuals like this take the initiative. And these individuals are out there. These kids are out there. This desire is out there. But unfortunately, our facilities, as you can see, fall woefully short. Minnetonka Skate Park is there on upper right. That was torn out 2 years ago. It was a failed skate park. I'm sorry. It was there for a number of years. Asphalt, modular equipment. Participation levels went down because it's a terrible skate park. Bottom line.
Representative Akin. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I was on the Egan City Council is when young people started coming asking for a skate park. And it took years to get that built because of trying to get the insurance for the facility. Obviously, we've come past that, and both Egan and Burnsville recently redid their skate parks. My grandson, who lives in California, is an avid skateboard person, so he has used many of our facilities here. Plus, when I was visiting last time, I went with him to a new park near him, which it was fairly small. But the most impressive one is the one that's in a shopping center, and I can't remember. It's a sporting goods store. So when you go in, you can see the sporting goods stuff. But the back, it's huge. And there were like a couple of fathers with their young kids that were doing this. It was amazing. And are you aware of what facility that I'm talking about in California?
I don't. I mean,
before slide.
Sorry. One of our things here may be describing the Vans Park in California. But yeah, yeah.
It's a city. It was huge.
They're used. Yeah. They're very much, very popular and very much used. Yes.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagelmont, I want to direct your attention to page 2, lines 2.25 through 2.32 first. And before I do that, I preface that by asking the Chair, this is going back to Ways and Means with a referral probably to Cap Invest. To Capital Investment
Capital,
from Ways
yes,
and Means?
Yes, that is. It is going back to Ways and Means with the recommendation that it be sent to Capital Investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Wagelmont, when we talk about general obligation bonds in a bonding request, could you explain to me what you mean by line point 2.26 when you talk about cooperative purchasing agreements for the purpose of purchasing skate park equipment and services?
Representative Wagelmont.
I'm just going to read it through. You know,
Mr. Forsley.
Chair, yes, thank you. Thank you for recognizing me. I think that is, again, the bonds is working with the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, again, helping the communities access the proper design and construction of the facilities, and just to make sure that this money is actually spent for actually quality equipment. Again, not repeating the mistakes that we've made in the past in some of the communities. So I believe that's what it's addressing.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Further down there, Representative Wolgamont talks about on lines 2.3 and 2.31, talks about fees collected must be deposited into a revolving fund established by the subdivision. Money appropriated to the commission administer the programs and services covered. Once you're releasing the general obligation bonds for the purpose of the project, what does that section entail in terms of reissuing bonds or reissuing funding from that? What does that entail and what does that subscribe to?
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, when we put this bill together, that was what we were told by council to be the best way to do this. I don't know if our House Research is here would like to explain in better detail than I what that would do, but that was in consultation and putting this bill together, that's what we told would be the most functional way to administer this.
Yeah, if I may speak, Chair.
I believe that I'm conferring with staff here that the person that drafted this is not here today. The researcher, you might want to talk offline with Representative Albright and get the answer to that, because we don't have that answer here today.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, I just have one follow-on to that then. Representative Wolgamott, and you can probably do your homework on this one too, with regard to on page 3, lines 3.1 through 3.5, when you're talking about general obligations, special tax bonds for skate parks, and maybe paid from sports and health club sales tax revenues, I've never seen language proprietary to a project like this incorporated into a bonding issue. So I think there needs to be some nuancing on the language to conform to what would typically be a bonding allocation. If you could address that.
Representative Wolgamott, I think you're getting instructions to look at that closely and maybe change to that. It is something that's different in the bill, but I've not seen before. But
yeah, like I said, when we put this bill together, that was what looked like to be the best format. But certainly willing to look at that with the person and follow up with you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the representative. Are there similar programs for local baseball fields?
Representative Wolgamott.
I don't think we've had a shortage of baseball fields in Minnesota, and quality baseball fields. So I don't know of any. I know there's probably been facilities at a state level, college level, indirectly state funds, but I don't think they've needed a grant program at this point. And actually, from our experience working with Minneapolis and other cities, they're actually getting rid of baseball fields at the moment. And we're not trying to pit this as a baseball versus the soccer thing. We're just trying to bring skate parks up to a quality where they're used and they're hopefully a community asset. So I guess the history of baseball is they haven't needed a grant program to get them built.
And Representative Volker, I think you mentioned early in the beginning of your discussion here, you explained the bill. This is kind of in line with the Muddy Ducks program.
That's right.
To encourage building these things, like we're encouraged to build hockey arenas and for kids that were skating, because that was at one point that was a shortage of those around, and I think this is mirroring that. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm taking that as a no. Let's go on. Is there anything similar for soccer fields?
Representative Vogel, Representative Wolgamott.
Again, this is really just to make sure that we're hearing from people all throughout the state, from youth all throughout the state, that there's a need for skate parks. And so this bill is just intended to give opportunities to communities all throughout the state and make sure that they have the opportunity to have funding to create skate parks.
And Representative, the statute book in 240A.13, there's a soccer field development funds that are already in statute, so it would be similar to that.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've actually got a list here of...
Representative Vogel, we're running short on time.
And I realize that, but, this to me is we're taking general obligation bonds. We're going to make them paid for by multiple generations that come after us. And there's a fairness and an equity issue here. And that's what I'm after, is these are really nice ideas. But I put down trap shooting, I put down dance, I put down swimming, I put down tennis, I put down football, I put down track and field. Now, some of those things are done through schools, and they're already being bonded for. When we do stuff like this for individual sports in individual cities, which this does, and are taking bonding money, I think we have to be really careful because we're discriminating against those other entities that aren't getting it. And to the case of baseball fields, the city that I happen to live in has been building a tremendous baseball program and doing it with their own funding. There are other cities that might want to do the same thing, even though baseball might be spurned by some people. So I think when we do this, Mr. Chair, we have to be careful not to discriminate and pick winners and losers. If we're going to do this, then we should do it holistically or we should not do it at all. Thank you.
And Representative Vogel, those are all good questions, and those are questions that are more appropriate for the bonding committee that makes those choices of what they're going to put in the bonding bill. Representative Wolgamott, if you want to quickly answer, and we need to get to a vote here.
Yeah, I think that we should be looking at all different kinds of things. If you feel passionately about a certain sport and build a coalition like we have with this, with the skating community and the local governments, would definitely encourage you to work out a bill, Representative Vogel. But we've got this coalition, we've put in the work, we've got a plan, we see a need, and we're excited to address that.
And with that, Representative, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2490, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be sent to Capital Investments. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
Next bill we have again is House File 1303, Representative Purcell, and members, we've heard this bill before. I'll move that House File 1303 be held over for further consideration. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill should help you catch up here on your time, so. Mr. Chair, members, as you've indicated, we did hear this bill was passed last year and just came up on the short end of full funding in the end. So we're here today seeking the remainder of the funding for the community broadcast stations, the three amper stations I have in my district, and they're all around the state, and you can tell by the authors on this bill that that there's pretty broad support. I have three stations, KAXE in Grand Rapids, KBXE in Bemidji, and KOJB, which is licensed to the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in Cass Lake, Minnesota, just to hop and a skip from where I live. And they're all doing good work. And I would offer, if you're up in my district, tune into one of them because you're going to hear some pretty good programming and probably some of the best old 60s music you ever will hear. You think you're back in Forrest Gump or something like that. It's such good music. So anyway, with that, I turn it over to my testifier here, Joel Glazer.
Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Glazer, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Good morning, members. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer, and I am the CEO of AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. First off, thank you for not only having me here today, but thank you for the funding that you did appropriate to AMPERS in the last session. Most of you are familiar with AMPERS, so I will keep my testimony very brief. I know Representative Jordan is new, although I guess maybe she has stepped out. But I also know that there is often confusion between AMPERS and Minnesota Public Radio, so just a very, very brief explanation of the difference. We are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, or Minnesota Public Television Association. We represent 18 independent community radio stations, with 17 of the 18 being eligible to receive state funding. They primarily serve underserved communities, and we define underserved as communities of color, Native American, new immigrant, in some cases students, and 14 of the 18 stations are in greater Minnesota. We have programming in 12 different languages, Hmong, Somali, Oromo, Ojibwe, and more. Between 1,200 and 1,500 students work at the stations each year. The stations rely very heavily on volunteers, some as many as 300. They are programmed by and for their local community, and none of the stations are allowed to run commercials. As far as why we are here today, we are requesting $250,000 from the general fund, $200,000 for the community service grants that will be distributed equally to the 17 stations that are eligible for state funding, and $50,000 for equipment grants that would be distributed equally among those same 17 stations. If I can draw your attention to the handout, specifically at the graphs on the back, you'll see that our request puts us back to where we were in FY16 and FY17. In FY16 and 17, we received an increase in that biennium because we had two new stations, WGZS in Fond du Lac and KRPR in Rochester. Despite the fact that those two stations are a permanent addition to AMPERS, the funding increase was only a one-time appropriation. So in the two biennia since, we have received $250,000 less in each biennium. There are actually two negative aspects to that decrease. The appropriation is obviously $250,000 less, so there's less money available. But the stations are all now dividing that money among 17 rather than 15 stations, so it's less money being watered down even further. We are here today simply to ask that you return us to our FY16, FY17 funding level by appropriating $200,000 for our community service grants and $50,000 for our equipment grant. Chair Nelson, members, that's all I have for the committee, but I am available should you have questions.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is probably more of a question for staff, but or for Representative Purcell, but answer me this. On lines 1.5 and line 1.12, there is additional funding. Is that in addition to the base funding that was passed into law last session, or is this a new appropriation?
Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, committee staff had recommended that we reintroduce the bill as is and that it would be amended to be included, the $250,000 to be amended and included in as it moves forward.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you instigated the question based upon the numbers that you cite, based upon what's in the bill here before us, but I don't see any amendment to identify with what you just stated as the intention of the bill. So are we not seeing something here that should be in our packet, or the intention to do that later as opposed to doing it here in Stakeify?
Representative Albright, that we're holding this bill over for further consideration, pending whether we get a target or not,
okay.
Whether we may find out later today, later this morning, and they're gonna, the budget forecast is coming out, and then the process of setting targets. This would come out of our target like it did last year. We didn't get, in the conference committee, they didn't get the full amount of the funding that they had last year. So at such time that would come forward, if we did get a target and we would put a bill together, we'd probably amend it then, because then we would know what our numbers are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Glazer, I guess that's the question. Any further questions? Any questions from anybody else? Anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? If not, again, I'll renew my motion. We're going to hold this over for further consideration.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Purcell. Thank you, Mr. Glazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
The next bill on our is House File 1372, and The motion, I'll move that House 1372 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And welcome to the committee, Representative Long, and I see you have a guest.
I do.
And if you want to explain your bill and what it does.
Sure thing. So I'm going to start with a story to illustrate the bill. I, on Sunday, was at a community event in my neighborhood and was speaking to one of my neighbors, talking about the upcoming election. And this wasn't planned, but was timely. She said, well, you know, I am planning to vote coming up this election, and I have a disabled child at home. And so we always vote from home, and we request absentee ballots. But I had to call Secretary Simon's office, the Secretary of State, because I wasn't sure if I was going to get my ballot mailed. I checked this box saying that I was a permanent absentee voter, but it turned out I wasn't. And that I needed to fill out a form to get it mailed. So I'm glad I called, because I might not have gotten the form otherwise. And I said, well, funny you should say that. I have a bill that would fix that, that is getting heard this week. So this bill would simply help voters' preferences right now, if they check the box saying that they want to be a permanent absentee voter, be realized, and so they would be mailed ballots rather than have to fill out a form every single time they have face a new election. And there are about 24,000 Minnesotans right now who have designated this. Many other states do it this way, and we don't. Those states include Arizona, Montana, and Utah. This is much easier from the voters who choose to vote from home for any number of reasons. Folks, it would help out the disability community, helps out a lot of students who travel, helps out seniors. And importantly, it also streamlines the process for counties and cities and reduces their administrative and financial burden. And that's, I think, the reason why the Minnesota Association of County Officers and the League of Minnesota Cities support this bill. So it's pretty straightforward. I know we're also here for the fiscal impact. Maybe I can let the Secretary of State
And before we go farther, Representative Long, I see you have an amendment. Do you want to move your amendment?
Yes, please. That would be great. The amendment is designed to help clarify two things. One is to the way the bill was originally drafted, we had this apply to ballots that mail, or to jurisdictions that mail all their ballots, and that doesn't make sense, so we're fixing that. And then there was a mistake in terms of the timing in the bill. So I'd like to move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Long moves the A2 amendment. He's explained it. Any questions of the amendment? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, and this might be a question for you either or the Secretary, but I'm curious as to jurisdiction that conducts elections entirely by mail. Could you just elaborate in terms of what that really means?
I think Secretary Simon can answer that question. Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Albright. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. We have 145,000 Minnesotans, including some in many of your districts, particularly if you represent greater Minnesota communities, who live in jurisdictions that vote only by mail. To qualify, a jurisdiction has to have either be a city of 400 or fewer registered voters, not people, but registered voters, or a township outside the 7-county metro area. If you're in one of those two categories, you can choose, no one can force you, but you can choose to give up your polling places and vote only by mail. And cities, small cities and townships adding up now to 145,000 people are in that boat. And we have counties now in Minnesota, off the top of my head, you know, Marshall County, Kitson County, Lake of the Woods County, several others that are now almost entirely, the entire county, vote by mail jurisdictions. They do not have polling places. They do not hire election judges. They do not own elections equipment. And so one of the reasons I think this bill makes sense, as long as I have the microphone, is this is basically a version of that. We already have 145,000 Minnesotans who live in places where they automatically get sent. Every election, they get sent a ballot. This was just to extend that same courtesy to people who fall into a different category.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, we are in the thrust and throes of deliberating over the primary. How does this amendment with mail only affect the opt-in or opt-out consideration for a primary, presidential primary? Is there any effect to that, or is it minimal, or help me understand how that might affect people's disenfranchisement from voting.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I don't think it would. I see this particular change as a technical one. I think Representative Long was right to catch that. There's no reason. We have a separate process for the folks that I just described that doesn't need to be bound up into this separate application process for the rest of us who don't live in a township or a city of 400 or fewer. So I see it as a technical change, and I think it's a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions on the amendment?
On the amendment.
If not, all in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is passed. Secretary Simon, do you want to talk on the bill or just want to answer questions?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to talk in case members had questions about the financial part. I'm happy to discuss policy too, but Representative Long seems to have that very well covered. In terms of the fiscal note, in case members have questions, I mean, you can read it for yourself. There's a lot of programming that has to happen, over 200 hours of programming to make this switch. Programming in the SVRS, the Statewide Voter Registration System, it's the database that we run, as many members know, it's sort of the spine of the election administration system. And so there would be significant programming there. Comes out, as you see, to, you know, not a ton of money in the scheme of the overall statewide budget, but that's why it exists. So I'm here to answer any questions members have on that.
Okay, Representative Jordan, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, are we only asking about the fiscal note, or are we asking about the bill in general?
A bill in general, fiscal note, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I was recently elected in a special election, and I know a number of my constituents had trouble accessing absentee ballots, particularly with the two-week window for the general. And I'm just wondering, would this also apply to special elections, and would there be a procedure for making sure the special election ballots got mailed to people?
Oh. Representative Simon and Secretary Simon and yeah. Representative Jordan, I also first ran in a special election while we were in session, and it is a bit of a rush when that happens. You don't even you lose a month. But Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan. Yeah, special elections are rough in a lot of ways. One of which is the compressed deadlines across the board, whether it's filing, absentee voting, anything else. So that makes it particularly tricky, but the short answer to your question is yes, this would apply to special elections as well.
Representative Jordan.
So even when we're doing, so will there be special instructions for Mr. Chair, Secretary Simon, would there be instructions given, especially when we have a very limited window with which to return those ballots?
Secretary Simon.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, yes, that's always the case. We include the instructions. A lot of people don't even know to look for the instructions or don't know what the rules are. But yes, once they request, once they're on the list, they would get that instruction and they would be told what the dates are. As you know by personal experience, it's a very compressed schedule.
And if I may, I think
Representative Long,
I think a special election is a perfect example of how this bill is helpful because special elections come up quickly. There's not a lot of time for folks to get an application back in to, you know, apply for the ballot. And this would just say, if you've told the Secretary of State that you want absentee ballots, that you want to be a voter who votes absentee, then you'll get a ballot every election. And I think that would help improve participation in a lot of different contexts.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for a little bit of enlightenment, it was worse. There were more difficulties, and we did make some improvements. There was a special election some years ago of where some of the mailed ballots came the same day that they'd have to be mailed back. And in a rural area, the postman comes by, drops it off, and doesn't pick up till the following day. And those type of things, I think, are addressed maybe in a different bill. But on this bill, if I could be enlightened on sort of the steps, process, flowchart type thing of, you know, you're doing the software, you're entering and changing this. So somebody fills out a voter registration, what are the steps leading up to the entering of that into the software?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. Well, it's not necessarily after they register to vote, but if someone were to, under Representative Long's bill and then law, if someone were to fill out the application, it's really a modification of what we have now. Right now, the step is if someone fills out the permanent
absentee application list. That's all that's available in current law. That means every election they get an application automatically mailed to them. This would be the same thing, same steps, only now they would get the actual ballot. But in terms of the IT sort of timeline, I think the fiscal note explains it in some detail, but there are just a number of steps that have to happen, not just with programming, but also with testing, if that's what you're getting at, the actual testing of the software as well. So it's not just the programming, unless I'm misunderstanding.
Representative Blom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I was looking at is, I understand in the current system, there are issues of where somebody registers and it's discovered that, you know, it's a bad registration or there's difficulties with that, and that there are, you know, sometimes tens of thousands of that might fall into that category. But I also understand that certain voter lists weren't appropriately cleared of those. So if there somebody did register and it was determined that it was a bad registration, that you know, they're already on this list, they're going to perpetually get an absentee ballot.
I see what you're saying.
And when you're doing the software update, are you also going to fix so that we actually clear out the bad records before we start sending a permanent absentee ballot out to a bad registration?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, yeah, I see what you're saying now. This would, so I'm trying to distinguish between registration and someone who maybe otherwise puts bad information, wrong information, untruthful information on the application. When it comes to voter registration, this wouldn't change any of that process. Right now, if a discrepancy cannot be resolved, you know, nobody is registered to vote, even when they register online, until a human being screens it. And if that can't be reconciled, if there's inadequate information, if there's wrong information, if there's a lie on there, if that can't be reconciled, there's no discretion. Election administrators in counties and cities and townships must turn it over to law enforcement. There is no, we'll get to it later, or we've got bigger priorities or fish to fry. They must turn it over. And then in turn, law enforcement must investigate it. They also can't defer and say, we've got other things that we're busy, or we've got other priorities. They must investigate that too. So that process would not be changed. As to the actual application, let's say someone lied on the application. They're already registered to vote, and they've been deemed lawful, but for some reason they put wrong information on the actual application. That too, we already have the systems in place to handle that with respect to the application to vote absentee. So that wouldn't change. Nothing about that system would change. Nothing would alter the absence of discretion for elections administrators. Nothing would alter the absence of discretion for law enforcement.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is because when the legislative auditor went through and they looked at the registration process, there were a large quantity of ones that weren't indicated that they were what was done with them. They did a sampling then as a follow-up. In fact, I think that probably came during or after the time that I sent out a letter requesting an understanding what happened. And the Secretary of State's office said, well, the counties do that. So I sent out letters to basically the largest counties and also sampling regional wise, and the county said, oh, we can't do that. We don't have access. It's not possible. Those were the types of responses, so that no one was owning up to verifying that these were fixed. The OLA did the sampling, and in the sampling, they found hundreds of cases of people that, bad registrations that did vote. And also with same-day registration, your vote's already counted before an early registration. There are cases where your vote's already counted before you even verify whether it's good or bad. In the HAVA, site set up to do this verification. I think in 16 it was a cycle, there was 16,000, and 18 I think was over 15,000. They came up as mismatches, and these are part of those that nobody said they had the responsibility or capability to verify. That's why anytime we do something that makes it permanent, somebody signs up permanently to get a ballot sent out to them, I always try to wonder what are the concerns, checks and balances, and I'm not hearing reassurance of it. I understand, and I think there are some cases where this is really a wonderful thing. I just wish I had more, I had a better comfort feeling that somebody, a bad actor, domestic or foreign, could game the system. That's why I was trying to hopefully get a better idea, but apparently it's same as current process.
Representative or Secretary Simon, or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huam, I'm happy to talk with you offline as well. As you know, we've exchanged letters on this issue. I would just say, I think your concern is more about the registration process, and in my judgment, it seems like it's less about this process. There are 17 or 18 states that have some version of this. Their political complexions are all over the map, from Hawaii and Connecticut to Mississippi, Alabama, Utah, Montana. They have some version of this. And so I'm quite confident that if they can do it, we can do it. It's only a step away from what we already have.
Representative Elkins.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurred to me that probably a lot of people who might take advantage of this program might have be people with permanent disabilities who would regularly, but this would be a lot more convenient for them to vote. Do we have any sense for how large that population is that is having to repeatedly request a new application every year that would fall into that category?
And Secretary Simon, the senior citizens, that the growing number of baby boomers that are becoming senior citizens, that also probably would help those people that can't or don't want to get out, especially in the middle of November, where we could have bad weather. Representative Long.
Yes, Representative Elkins, I think that's exactly right, and I think the constituent example I gave was speaks to that, where they had an adult disabled child, was much more comfortable for that individual to vote at home, and so they voted at home as a family, and that's why they wanted to be on the permanent list. But they had to fill out an application every single time, and it was unclear even to them, as folks who were active voters, whether they needed to do that. And so it might have been that they forgot to fill out the application one year and then couldn't bring their son with them to vote, right? So that's the situation we're trying to avoid. And I think as this becomes something that is easier, I think more folks in the disabled community would be able to participate and make it easier for them.
Thank you.
And Representative Secretary Simon and Representative Long, there is no appropriation that I see in the bill. Is the intent that the Secretary of State's office is going to absorb these costs, or are we looking to add an appropriation to this in ways and means if it gets to there or gets out of there? Secretary Simon. I see you looking.
That's right. This is the one. Okay. Just looking for a clue from staff here. Yes, this is one that that our office intends to absorb. Yeah.
Absorb the cost.
Yes, we'll absorb the cost. Yes.
Secretary, Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either one can answer my question, sir. I think the one is, you might seem silly, but I have to ask it. Do any of these ballots get mailed out of state? Are they only mailed inside Minnesota?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, no, this is just for Minnesota voters. Oh, I'm sorry. You're saying
absentee ballots.
Absentee, I see. Yes, they do.
Yes. Then the next question would be.
Representative Green, yes.
Yeah, do any even get mailed outside the country?
Secretary Simon.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, in narrow circumstances, that's possible. So, for example, I have a friend, this actually comes up once in a while, who, high school classmate, friend, He currently lives, a journalist, he lives in Malaysia. He gets something that's the federal-only ballot. It's a little tricky. There's a category of Minnesotans and Americans who the state that he claims as his residence is Minnesota, but he doesn't live here. He have to claim some state if you're American abroad, but he hasn't lived here for a long time. So he gets this very rare creature called the federal-only absentee ballot. So he can only vote for U.S. Senate, U.S. House, and president. He can't vote for a state legislator because he doesn't live in any particular place in Minnesota, but he's an American abroad who claims Minnesota as his home state. I know that's a tricky kind of issue, but yeah, there are limited examples of that.
So,
and military personnel too is the other one I would say. I'd say probably the biggest component is not people like my friend, journalists, it's people in the U.S. military.
And so Secretary Simon, so you're saying that a snowbird, say in Representative Jordan's district, that there was a special election, but in February they're living in Florida or Arizona or Texas or someplace like that where they go to, but they're still a resident and can continue their residency in some place in Minnesota, they could be mailed a absentee ballot currently without this bill, but this bill would just make it automatic.
Right.
Representative.
That's right, Mr. Chair. And I would add one other thing, just because it hasn't come up yet. If someone moves, whether they move to or from a foreign place, or even within, let's say they're working for 3M in Paris and they move to Nice or something, same country, you have to do it all over again. It doesn't follow you when you move. So if you're a permanent absentee, if you're a holder of this privilege under the bill and you live in, you know, Aiken County and you move to Ramsey County, you've got to reapply again. Similarly, if you are a Minnesotan like my friend and you live in Malaysia and now he's been reposted to Tokyo, he's got to do it again.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's concerning, but the question then becomes, once you're a permanent, you get the permanent ballot, with the application, you get the application every year, and if something changes, then you have to reapply. And every year or every voting cycle, which I think is reasonable to ask, what happens or are there any safeguards for those that, let's say, they may be snowbirds today, get tired of Minnesota taxes and change their residency? Do you have, does your office connect with other agencies to make sure that if any of that happens, you get notice of that?
Secretary Simon.
But Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely. And we're part of a consortium, a national consortium that does exactly that, that makes sure if someone has moved or becomes a resident of another state, that they're not on both voting lists. And that's been a national problem, but now, thanks to this national consortium called ERIC, that is rapidly disappearing.
Secretary, Representative Green.
Okay, and then also, thank you, Mr. Chair, do they also check against death records then as well? I know that there's been some concern, and even in my own precinct, when I was voting judge, once in a while you'd look at the roster and you'd see, you know, one or two people that had passed away, but they're still on the roster. Now, so that does appear to be a problem. So what safeguards do you have in place for that?
Sure.
Secretary
Thank
Science.
You, Mr. Chair and Representative Green. Yeah, we subscribe, our office subscribes and regularly, constantly checks two death indexes. There's the Minnesota Department of Health death index, and then there's the National Social Security death index, as do all other states too. So we do it organically just in and of ourselves, and we also check those records against what other states have through this National ERIC Consortium as well.
Okay. Then one last question and then a comment. The last question then is, you know, you said you've got this consortium that will check against people who move their residence. How quickly does that work? Is it immediate, or is there a lag time? Is there like a 6-month, 12-month lag time?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, it's pretty immediate. I can't say it's within minutes or hours, but it's quite quickly within the ERIC states.
And Secretary Simon, yeah. With that, when are the rosters printed ahead of the election?
Right.
I mean, are they 2 days, 10 days? When are they sent out? So some of them might have died within that, may still be on a printed roster.
Right. Typically rosters, you know, not all of them are printed anymore, Mr. Chair. And members, many of your jurisdictions that you represent are moving to e-poll books, so it's a little easier to do that. But they're printed typically where they're printed or where they're loaded, typically that Monday night before a Tuesday election. And the reason for that is we have absentee voting up until that day. So either at the counter in your counties, cities, or townships, or by mail, people are literally voting the day before the election, and the roster has to reflect people who have voted absentee so that when they walk in, they're not able to vote twice. They're not able to have voted absentee the day, the week, the month earlier, and walk in and have a second bite at the apple and vote in person. You can't do that, so the roster has to reflect that. It's a source of some anxiety among elections administrators in the county, cities, and townships that they have to wait till the night before. They'd love to have days more than that, but they don't under current law.
Well, and finally, thank you, Mr. Chair. Finally, just a comment. You know, as someone who really values our election process, and I always have from the time I started voting, and I don't think it's too much to ask for them to fill out that application. I think things change, and I'm not going to say people are doing it intentionally, but, you know, things change. And if that ballot comes in the mail and they have forgotten to update their application, is it really that big of a deal to mail out that application form for an absentee? I really don't think so. I think this is not necessary, and I won't be voting for it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, Secretary Simon. The first is to I note that you're absorbing the cost for the electronic enhancements that you need. Who will be doing that? Is that through Minute, or is that through your own internal staff?
Secretary Simon, I believe you're not bound by Minute. That's because as an executive branch or constitutional officer, you're not bound by Minute.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, we do all our stuff in-house. We only use Minute for a couple things, like email and phones and things like that. We do all our stuff in-house.
Representative Albright.
Just a final question then, and this might be getting off into the deep stuff here, but with a growing population and people living in retirement communities and advancing in age, on the ballot that they would receive, is there an attestation that they are making this choice and the selection of their own, notwithstanding a power of attorney or that type of thing, but so that there isn't a concern about undue influence being imposed upon that person, whether they're in a retirement community or an at-risk individual that might fall prey to someone that has not less than honest intentions with the aid that they might provide to that individual.
Our Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright, great question. That's why really we have the witness requirement. There is a witness requirement, and that person is attesting that the voter is the one who has voted and no one else. And it is an increasing issue for all of us to think about with aging parents and others. You want to make sure that safeguard is there, that no one is whispering in their ear or filling it out completely for them and that kind of thing. That's why I think we maintain the witness requirement.
Thank you.
Representative Acomb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make a quick comment and thank you for bringing the bill forward. I think that for most people, requesting a ballot isn't an issue. But there are those people, my husband included, who lives with multiple sclerosis. And from day to day, you don't know how they are going to be able to handle the daily functions of life. And so having a program like this, where a person can be on a permanent list to be sent something, to be able to participate in our democracy, is a pretty easy and welcome opportunity. So I appreciate the bill. Thank you.
Representative Elkins, did you have a follow-up? I think I might have missed that. Or
yeah, I did. On the question of
Mr. Chair,
cost,
if I could just
sorry.
Now, Representative Long.
To Representative Acomb's point, I think that's exactly right, and I think that right now the intent of individuals who are checking permanent absentee is that they expect to be getting a ballot every time. That's what it seems like, right? If you have a box that says permanent absentee voter and you check that box, then you think you're done and that you've filled it out. But right now we're not really meeting the intent of individuals. And so I think this would not only reduce the burden, but it would help actually reflect what people think they're signing up for.
Representative Elkins, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the question of the fiscal impact of this, it would seem to me that at least over time that the Secretary of State's office would actually save money from this.
Secretary Simon, and I think I asked that question offline, and I think it's the counties that save money by not having to mail the applications out, but I'll let the Secretary of State answer.
No, Mr. Chair, well put. I think that's exactly right. It's not so much that we would, but all of your counties and cities and townships would save a lot of money. Right now, it's a two-step process. They got to send two waves of paper. First, the application, then they get the application back, then the ballot. Costs money. They're going to save that money. And I just want to echo what Representative Long says. Mm-hmm. Just talking before the hearing with our elections director, who's also here, David Maeda, who has a long history in elections administration at the county and city level, he said, only half jokingly, that sometimes it seems like close to 100% of the people on the current list are rightly confused. They think they've signed up to get a ballot, and what they get in the mail is an application, and they're puzzled. And we and elections administrators all over the state get puzzled and anxious phone calls saying, wait a minute, where's my ballot? That's what I thought I was signing up for when I signed up for this. So there's a lot of confusion out there, not to mention the expense, as your question implies.
Yeah, I was just say this is one of many things, Mr. Chair, where the impacts really do fall on the counties, and elections is one of the more key ones, because it's all done at the city and county level. And just a final observation, Mr. Chair, is that I followed the deliberations of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Council on IT reform all during the interim, and we heard presentations from just about all of the state agencies. And I have to say that the presentation from your office, Secretary of State Simon, was one of the most impressive. And so I already knew coming in here, for example, that your office takes the postal change of address file, takes the Social Security death master file, takes change of address information from driver and vehicle services. I think your office is actually doing the best job of any state agency when it comes to deduping and maintaining the accuracy of the records for citizens in the state. So I want to commend your IT staff on the good job that they're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two quick clarifications. One, it was touched upon if a large number were sent out to a certain facility. What are the limitations? Can one person at that facility be the witness for everyone?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, and in terms of the witness, I don't want to confuse that with vouching. So, yes, mm-hmm. In terms of a witness, yes, one person can witness. We have an 8-person limit for vouching in Minnesota. That's a whole different thing. But for the witness, yes.
Okay. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, because that does add some consideration. The one person collects all the mail and ballots instead of distributing a check and balance. But the other one is you've verified that the state and nationally there's quite a bit of activity to try and help with people that pass on. But according to our state constitution, if someone comes under guardianship, are no longer able to handle their own affairs, they, according to the state constitution, do not, no longer can vote. Is there an automatic situation that corrects the voting status of a person when they come under guardianship?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwong, I'm glad you mentioned that, because you're right, there's language about guardianship and voting in the state constitution, but the judicial interpretation of that in Minnesota for the last several years, I think 10 years or more, has been that the presumption is that someone under guardianship does have the right to vote, maintains it, unless there's a specific court order saying that they don't. So just being under guardianship does not deprive a Minnesotan of the right to vote. It takes a next step. It takes court action to affirmatively say this person is no longer qualified to vote. That's the way the courts have interpreted it.
And Secretary Simon, so does your office, I think that's the follow-up question that Representative Kwong has, that don't mean to jump on him, but
yes.
Do you get notification of those court orders?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwong, yes, we do.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that, things are taken care of.
Anybody else in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing nobody rushing down to the dais, Representative Long, you want to wrap up quickly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thanks. I think we've gone over the reasons that this bill is needed. It's a a pretty straightforward fix that I think has worked well in a number of other states and would help meet the intent of voters and make it easier for Minnesotans to vote.
With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 1372, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is approved and the bill is on its way. Thank you. And members, with that, we have no meeting tomorrow because of the caucuses, and we can't have any meetings till afternoon. So with that, members, we're adjourned.